Arriving in the Egyptian capital to what looks like a hero's welcome. This is the Turkish Prime Minister's first stop in his regional tour of states swept along by the Arab Spring. Joined by his foreign minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan will be trying to boost his country's ties and cooperation with Egypt's new leaders. Al Jazeera reports the arrival of Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Egypt, part of a trip last month which also took in Tunisia and Libya, other Arab Spring nations. Hello, Keri Phillips here. Thanks for joining me for Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, online and by podcast. Today we'll look at Turkey since the election of Erdogan, a man some feared might push an Islamic agenda on a constitutionally secular state. Instead, he's surprised many with his ambitious plans for his country and its role in the world. A successful, prosperous Muslim democracy, Turkey has become a significant economic and political force, especially in its own region, over the last decade. Hugh Pope has been writing about the Middle East and Turkey for the last 30 years, firstly as a journalist and now as the project director for Turkey-Cyprus with the International Crisis Group. When I spoke to him on Skype, I asked him what was going on in Turkey when Erdogan won office in 2002.
Turkey was in almost blind funk in 2002. It was a very difficult time. There'd been a huge financial shakeout in 2000-2001. And in fact, the election in 2002 that the AKP swept the polls in was one where a lot of people stayed away. There was a sense of real confusion in the electorate.
Tell us something about Erdogan himself. What kind of politician was he at that point? I understand he'd been mayor of Istanbul, but he'd also been in jail. What was his background?
Erdogan is from a rather poor, mixed district by the banks of the Golden Horn Sea Inlet in Istanbul. It's a working-class area. And in fact, he grew up at a time when there were still Greek, Armenian and other minorities, gypsies too, in that area. And if you were not tough, and if you did not stand up for yourself, then you would be smashed. And he was educated in a religious-oriented school, in those days mainly for training clerics, supposedly, but also chosen by conservative and religious-minded families. And he took in a lot of the nationalist side of Turkey's education. And he joined very early on. He joined the most religious party in Turkey. In those days, he would have qualified as an Islamist. He certainly talked like that. And grew through the ranks of the Islamist party and gradually became head of the youth wing. And he built up an extraordinary organization, which has been his great calling card throughout his career, his ability to get other people to work for him. And he defied the old-fashioned leadership of that party to stand for mayor in 1994, if I remember rightly, and again won against the odds. Huge panic in Istanbul, but it turned out that he was quite a good manager of the city, and his reputation grew to the point that he was a real challenge to the established authorities in the Islamist party. At that point, the secular system, the old Kemalist, secularist, nationalist group that has run Turkey for 90 years since the time of Kemal Atatürk, kicked in, and they tried to derail him with a court case after he read out a poem that sounds very Islamist. It's about the minarets being our spears and the domes of the mosques being our shields. It's actually in the Turkish national curriculum. It's a national poem. But the way he read it out was possible to make him look like an Islamist, which is against the law in Turkey. So, as you say, he was thrown in jail, which was quite a shocking experience for him, I suspect. A lot of Turkish prime ministers have gone through a period of jail. It's not that unusual, but he certainly came out of it determined to change things. His big leap forward was when he decided to break completely with the old Islamist politicians that he'd grown up under and founded a new party in 2001, the Justice and Development Party. And he took with him his vote-winning organization from Istanbul. And in the confused elections of 2002, this is what won him the day.
This was a remarkable result for 48-year-old Tayyip Erdogan and the party he founded only 15 months ago. All through the evening, loyal supporters outside his campaign headquarters cheered ecstatically each new local constituency result as it appeared on a big screen on the street outside.
Egal Schleifer is a freelance journalist who was based in Istanbul between 2002 and 2010, where he covered Turkey and the surrounding region. He now writes the blog Istanbul Calling. When I spoke to him on Skype, he suggested that Turkey's potential had been lying dormant.
Prior to 2002, Turkey was seen as a country that was perennially punching below its weight, a kind of junior partner to the United States, a relatively dependable ally, and a country that was more or less going to go along with what others tell it to do. But I think the strong image was of the country punching below its weight, not quite ready to play in the big leagues. And this had to do with a variety of reasons, a series of pretty inefficient, corrupt coalition governments over the years. So you had, Turkey had just in 2002 was still coming out of a major economic crisis, had again, a series of coalition governments that were very ineffective, corrupt. So the country was not operating at its peak capacity or its peak ability. And the Justice and Development Party, which came in 2002 under the leadership of Erdogan, clearly had a very different vision for the country. Yeah, you know, I think what they represented at that time is a new kind of governance for Turkey itself. The name of the party, which the initials in Turkish are AK Party, and AK also means white in Turkish. So the idea was that this is going to be the clean party. Their motto is a light bulb, a kind of shining light bulb. So the imagery there, you know, was very clear in terms of we're clean, we're bright, we're going to be illuminating and, you know, sort of getting rid of a lot of the darkness that was here before, either through corruption or through shady political dealings. So I think that's what people were ready for. Right? You know, I think over the years, then what they rolled out or unveiled this more ambitious plan for Turkey as a regional leader, as a global actor, and as a dominant economic player, too.
The Justice and Development Party won an absolute majority of parliament seats in the 2002 general elections, sweeping from power the ruling secularist elite that, along with the army, had dominated Turkey's political life since independence in 1923. But despite his past Islamist connections, the new Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was not propelled by a fundamentalist religious agenda.
On a national scale, his main ideology is development. They love business. I've just was the weekend driving hundreds of kilometers around eastern Turkey. They're building roads everywhere. There's a lot of building going on in Turkey. Provincial towns have changed out of recognition. It's that kind of development that he really and his party really likes. It annoys people. It's a bit nouveau riche in some ways, but at the same time, it's changed the face of Turkey. So I think that it's a business-minded approach. It's about Turkey getting richer. I think he had various goals from his constituency to do with allowing women to wear headscarves much more widely in Turkey. When he came into power, it was not at all done and, in fact, illegal to wear headscarves in public institutions and schools and universities. They really pushed it, and they actually tried to push it through the European Court of Human Rights. But in 2005, the European Court of Human Rights, in a rather surprising decision, certainly for the Justice and Development Party and Erdogan, said that you should not take down the secular barrier to wearing headscarves in universities. But at the same time, frankly, I think in many universities, it's quietly now allowed. People are just being permitted to wear their headscarves. So in that sense, they've got their way. I think he wanted a more observant society. I live in the center of Istanbul. It's 9 years after they took power. It's perhaps their second or third attempt to do so. But now you don't see people sitting on the streets drinking beer at any time of day or night in the center of Istanbul. The cafe culture has been pushed back inside. I mean, alcohol is not banned, but the overt consumption of it in the middle of the city has been banned, and it's been an evolutionary change. And I think that it still remains the case that if Erdogan and AKP, the Justice and Development Party, were to do something overtly Islamist for Islamist reasons, for instance, pushing the beer drinkers off the streets of Istanbul was a municipal decision to do with zoning rather than based on the Sharia law. If they were to become overtly Islamist, they would then lose the ability to win elections. So I think they go very carefully on that one.
We think of Turkey as a secular country, which has a secular system that's been in place since 1923 when the modern Turkish Republic was founded. But, you know, the vast majority of the population are people who are let's say, socially conservative, that Islam plays a certain role in their life in terms of shaping family relations or even social or commercial relations in a certain way. And many of them come from the interior of the country, from, let's say, smaller provincial cities as opposed to Istanbul or Izmir or the cities along the coast. You know, in a certain way, the party looks more like Turkey, you know, at least the Turkey that maybe a lot of people don't see because people come to visit Istanbul or some of the coastal resorts. But the base of the party in many ways are people from the heartland, let's say.
Since the 2002 elections, Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party have been re-elected twice, most recently in June, when they were returned with almost 50% of the vote. Erdogan's popularity rides on the spectacular economic growth Turkey has enjoyed since he came to office, especially in largely rural Anatolia, the AKP's power base, where life has been transformed.
You could make the argument they got onto a train that was already heading in the right direction. As I said, just before they took power, there'd been a huge financial crisis in Turkey, and a completely different government set the country back on the rails, no question about that. But they kept going. They've been pretty good economic managers of Turkey, far better than the 1990s. And as a result, we've had average growth rates of about 7%, which must make the Europeans weep with envy, especially when we have the 2008-2009 economic crisis. Yes, that hurt Turkey. Turkey's economy is about half European, if you like, linked by trade and investment. But on the other hand, Turkey's banking system had been sorted out in 2000-2001, so no banks went under. And Turkey's trade has soared extraordinarily. I mean, you can see that Turkish businesses are far stronger than they ever were before. And in terms of tourism, too, they may have taken the chairs off the pavements of Istanbul center's streets. But the fact is that tourism is booming as never before.
And despite the ruling party's conservatism, there's been substantial social and political change in Turkey over the last decade.
Yes, Turkey is a very different place. It's contested, however, how different it is, at least domestically. From the outside, there are huge differences. For instance, the question of torture in Turkey has more or less been eradicated from the jail system. I dare say that there's some rough treatment still in police stations, especially in rural areas, but it's not the human rights outrage that it was 10, 15 years ago. We no longer have death squads stalking the country, which was a dreadful feature of the 1990s efforts to combat the PKK insurgency, the ethnic Kurdish minority. That insurgency continues and it's actually escalated in the last few months. But up till now, Erdogan has managed to keep it more in the bounds of the rule of law than his predecessors. On freedom of expression, there are a lot of complaints now. The OSCE came up with a number, the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe. Press Freedom Watchdog came up with a figure of 50-plus journalists in jail, and that combined with a kind of feud that Erdogan had with the biggest media group, in which his government slapped a huge fine on them, $2 billion-plus fine on the main media group, persuaded people that he was anti-freedom of the press, again, combined with his ultra-sensitivity to any criticism. People will open court cases against people who criticize, or writers or caricaturists who criticize Erdogan on the slightest thing. So in that sense, there's definitely not an open system that you might find in a more settled country. But I believe that actually you can talk about a great deal more in Turkey today than when Erdogan came to power. I think that as people get wealthier in Turkey, as education becomes better, as information becomes more open, I think a lot of problems are digesting and solving themselves.
Turkish academic Mehmet Özkan has also observed significant social change in Turkey.
I mean, if I look at 10 years ago, there was a lack of internal dialogue, especially between seculars and Islamists, I would say, or seculars and Anatolian conservatives. But now, as both sides become conscious, and there is more tolerance, and people also, I mean, people communicate. You know, it is difficult to have a communication with ignorant people, those who have, like, fixed ideas. But when you have people conscious and there is a communication, they might disagree on many points, which is fine, but still there is a communication. It also contributes to the democratization of Turkey domestically, I would say. And I think that's a very healthy development.
Kerry Phillips here on Radio National with Rear Vision. Don't forget you can also listen to us online or sign up for a free weekly podcast by going to our website. You can also follow us on Twitter by searching for RN Rear Vision. Today's program is about Turkey and its rise as an economic and political force, especially in its own region, over the last decade. Mehmet Özkan's academic interests cover Turkey's growing diplomatic and economic engagement with Africa, which began long before Erdogan came to power, but increased during his time in office. Turkey declared 2005 the Year of Africa and planned 15 new embassies in various African countries. Mehmet Özkan says that business has driven Turkey's foreign policy.
Yes. I mean, this is one of the pillars of the Turkish foreign policy. Actually, many people, because of the call Turkey as a trading state, whether economic policy is running foreign policy. I mean, to some extent, it's true, because whenever Erdogan goes somewhere, he takes, 100 or 200 businessmen with him. Because here he understands that, without economic power, your influence is nothing. So he puts economy at the center of his understanding. He thinks that, when they establish an interdependence between countries, especially economically, the politics cannot change this relation. It will be always much better. So it will be unbreakable. That's why Turkey is involved in the Middle East, for example. It was mostly based on economics. I mean, for example, Syria, with all the countries, economy really increased a lot. I mean, trade relation between all these countries. But then comes then social relations, social understanding, then political relations follow them. For example, I just mentioned African case. For example, in Africa, I mean, most of times Turkish business association was leading Turkish embassies. So in those countries in Africa, there was no Turkish embassy, but there is active Turkish businessmen. I mean, state was trying to catch up this civil society development in a way, I would say, in terms of trade. But also state, there was a perfect convergence of, civil society, like businessmen associations and Turkish foreign policy. So both sides helping each other, I would say.
So it was a really adventurous, economically entrepreneurial society that led the way into those diplomatic adventures.
Yes. I mean, Turkey's economic opening started in early 80s, then when Turkey started to implement liberalization policies. But, I mean, in 80s, it was limited opening. It was opening mostly to Neve, to Russia, to very close areas. Then after 90s, and especially after, in late 90s, Turkey started to open to far away places like Latin America, Africa, Asia. Actually, there is a term that they call, Islamic Calvinist, which refers to Turkey's Anatolian conservative people. So maybe they don't speak even one word English, but they do trade with all over the world. So there is a newly emerging middle class in Anatolia. They were the supporters of Erdogan in many places and in many areas. So they were the main driver behind Erdogan's political support in Turkey, his policies.
As we'll see, this connection between Turkish diplomacy and Turkish business interests has created some difficulties during the upheaval of this year's Arab Spring. But even before the Middle East's pro-democracy movements had begun, Turkey's formerly sound diplomatic relationship with Israel had begun to unravel.
First, though, Israel is finding itself increasingly isolated on the world stage after its military raid on a flotilla of ships carrying humanitarian aid for Gaza.
There were furious protests on the streets of Turkey where many of those killed were from, and some of the strongest words were from Turkey's Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who says Israel deserves the harshest punishment.
Kadınların, çocukların.
This bloody massacre by Israel on ships that were taking humanitarian aid to Gaza deserves every kind of curse, he says. This attack was obviously an attack on the international law, the conscience of humanity, and world peace.
Turkey probably rashly allowed a group of Islamic-oriented aid organisation to join an aid flotilla to Gaza in the middle of the night as the ship was sailing south towards Egypt in international waters. The Israelis decided to up the ante and take it to Ashdod. And there was a big fight on the boat. And as we know, eight Turks and a Turkish-American were killed. And that level of escalation certainly wasn't decided on by Turkey. It was decided on by Israel. And when it comes to the apology, the whole UN commission looking into the flotilla disaster, the whole idea was to create an atmosphere in which an apology could be crafted that would be possible for Israel and acceptable to Turkey. And the negotiators reached that. and the Israeli cabinet rejected it. And this led to Turkey becoming extremely upset, and they have now reduced diplomatic relations to the minimum and are talking pretty tough against Israel in the region. I would certainly argue that Turkey's gone too far in its rhetoric towards Israel. I don't think that it's worth it to get this ephemeral support from the Arab street and risk alienating the American Congress. I think that Erdogan's gone too far with that, but he certainly feels that he shores up his image by taking this stand. And frankly, if you've ever talked to him about the subject, you can see that he believes that in the very roots of his being that he is very, very sympathetic with the Palestinians.
Turkey is one of Syria's closest allies and has tried to use those relations to persuade Syria of the need for reform and an end to the brutality. Tayyip Erdogan regards Syria's president as a friend, but he now appears to have lost patience altogether, accusing the Syrian regime, including the president's brother, of perpetrating atrocities. He spoke to Bashar al-Assad by phone. Unfortunately, I say very clearly that his brother is behaving inhumanely and he's pursuing brutality at the moment. They pose above women whom they've just killed. It gives such an ugly impression. These images are not ones you can stomach.
The pro-democracy demonstrations and popular upheavals in countries across the Middle East this year have come right to Turkey's doorstep, its long border with Syria. Well before 2011, though, Erdogan's government had attempted to engage more strongly with the Arab countries in its region.
Turkey had tried to present itself as the regional organizer, if you like. In 2009 especially, it started setting out a policy it called the Zero Problems Foreign Policy. It's very much associated with Erdogan's foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu. And this was actually an extremely sensible approach, idealistic perhaps, but it was very refreshing in a region where people have been more prone to invading and blowing each other up, in which Turkey explicitly said that it wanted to change the nature of the region. It wanted to open borders to trade, and it started signing free trade agreements. It wanted political cooperation. Again, in a region which no one cooperates with anyone else, they were setting up high-level ministerial councils that would meet twice a year. They opened the borders of Turkey to people. Middle Easterners now can visit Turkey without visas. This has made an extraordinary difference, at least to the streets. Outside my house here in Istanbul, now I think that sometimes I think half of the people walking down with snapping shots of the trams are actually from the Middle East. This is a big difference compared to, say, the last decade. Only 10% of the visitors to Turkey have been from the Middle East. Now, that was done with the intention of finding some stability in the Middle East, in Turkey's eastern neighborhood, very much to stop any sense of security threat for Turkey. Remember that Iran, Iraq, and Syria border Turkey and had been the source of very grave security threats for Turkey in the 1990s. So they wanted levers to prevent that. And secondly, Turkey does have the biggest economy of the region. It has the best factories. Even now, about 75% of Middle Eastern homes have a product that's been made in Turkey, and Turkey wanted to increase that. And so it was ready to push for it. And the Middle East was very interested in Turkey at the time, an interest that's expressed by the extraordinary success of Turkish television programs in the Middle East. Very many Middle Eastern broadcasters are buying dozens of Istanbul-made, Turkish-made soap operas and so forth, which have really boosted interest in Turkey and its achievements. That was all very well until it became clear that actually its zero problems with the region were zero problems with the governments in power, that is, Bashar al-Assad, Hosni Mubarak, Gaddafi, and so forth. Turkey hadn't really thought through what it meant to democratize the region. And of course, its commercial interests were all with the existing government. So when the Arab Spring hit, Turkey was caught a bit flat-footed, especially in Libya, where it has $15 to $30 billion of existing contracts. And so as long as it looked possible that Gaddafi would survive, of course, they tried to make sure that Gaddafi would have that there would be a smooth transition. But once it became clear that that was not going to happen, Turkey switched pretty smartly and cut him off and is now busily smothering the new National Transition Council with love and the expectation that its contracts will be restored, and I think they probably will. And we are seeing the same process with Syria. Very late to change course. many, many times going to visit Bashar al-Assad and begging him to do the sensible thing and allow a smooth transition rather than hang on till the last moment and perhaps bring the whole Syrian house down around him. But it's very clear, that, especially in the last few days, that Turkey has now determined that Bashar al-Assad has to go, and it's supporting the opposition. And the opposition has met three or four times now in Istanbul. And so I guess it's been a difficult transition for Turkey, but I think that we're seeing continued Arab interest in Turkey and continued ability for Turkey to influence events from the outside. I think that in the medium term, Turkey will have a big role there.
According to Hugh Pope, while Turkey has reached out to countries near and far, it seems to have given up on the drive for EU membership, the source of its recent modernization.
Erdogan has lost all interest in Europe. You can argue that also Europe has lost all interest in Turkey, which started this. But the fact is that Turkey, much as it has improved, the average income in Turkey is still half per person that it is in the European Union. The European Union has always acted as the locomotive for reform in Turkey. It still provides two-thirds of Turkey's foreign direct investment, which is the most valuable kind of investment it gets. And politically, that relationship is dead in the water. And Erdogan has taken a political decision not to do anything to improve it. And he will use it for domestic political purposes to show his people that he's angry with Europe, and that unfortunately is completely counterproductive in Europe. And I would say that's where Turkey would do well to cash in some of its high-value chips that it's gained as the power in the Middle East and buy some shares in the EU while they're cheap. Because, you know, yes, 25% of Turkey's trade is with the Middle East, but I think the tumult in the Middle East over the last year means that markets there will be much less rewarding for Turkey. And Turkey should remember that a lot of what it has achieved in the last decade under Erdogan has been achieved because of the huge energy released by the EU reform process that peaked in 2000-2004, around the time that Erdogan took power.
Despite those uncertainties, given Erdogan's obvious interest in engagement with the Middle East, is it possible that Turkey, an economically thriving secular Muslim state, could provide a role model for those searching for democracy in the Arab world? Mehmet Özkal says that each country will find its own path, although there is a great deal of interest in Turkey, for example in Cairo, where he was when I spoke to him.
Turkish model in the Middle East has been discussed mostly in the West, rather than in the region and in the church. For example, Turkey official says we can be an inspiration, but we will never be a model, because every country has its own social, historical, and even psychological context. So they are likely to develop their own model in a way. But if you look at the global Islamic movement perspective, I mean, the Turkish example break down the whole literature. They say that Islam and democracy is not compatible. And the case of Turkey breaks down this literature. I mean, in here, for example, in Cairo, I can observe that everybody has different perspectives for Turkish model. For example, Muslim Brotherhood, they look Turkey as a model because they want to come to power through election. They see from this perspective. For example, secular sections here in Egypt, they see Turkish model as a sort of a neutral state, and then the minority rights and secular rights will be observed and will be implemented. Society, if you look at society sees Turkish example as for economic development. I mean, for them, you know, the first thing, economy. So everybody has different understanding of modelhood. But in general, I would say Turkey has an indirect influence in this region, indirect influence. There are huge TV programs going on here explaining how Turkey was 20 years ago and how it is now. Every year, and newspapers, they prepare special editions, special page. But after several years, I think we will see Turkey's negative side as well, because Turkey has its own problem. So then they will try to look at different perspectives, probably. So they will try to find their own model.
Turkish academic Mehmet Özkal. We also heard from Egal Schleifer, writer of the blog Istanbul Calling, and Hugh Pope from the International Crisis Group. An updated edition of his book, Turkey Unveiled, will be published next month. Jenny Parsonage is the sound engineer for Rear Vision this week. Goodbye from Keri Phillips.